Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog, and as with the Speculist on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about the future, we talk about emerging technologies, we talk about cool stuff that is happening now and that's coming down the pipe. And on this kind of special edition tonight, we're going to be talking about the year in review. And with me on the program, I have Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, how are you, Phil?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Great.
Holidays treating you all right?
Okay, we're surviving.
All right.
Got through them.
Okay. Well, you know what? You still got one more to get through, actually.
Oh well, this one's fun from here forward.
That can be hard. To
the work is done. The work is done for parents of many kids like myself. Christmas is work, but New Year's is fun.
New Year's is relatively. Labor.
Relatively light in the work.
Lesser on the labor, for sure, absolutely. Yeah. And we also have PJ Manny with us. Hello, PJ.
Hello, gentlemen.
How are you?
Very well now, thank you.
Good.
Very well now. Now, help us through the now. What's up?
I've just gotten over pneumonia and have been all by myself these holidays, but my family's coming back from the Midwest tomorrow, and I'm very happy.
And the reason you were by yourself in the holidays is because y'all had planned to travel together, but you couldn't because you were sick. Is that right?
Absolutely. My doctor forbade me to fly the day before we were all supposed to go. And my husband has a not unsurprising horror of the idea of me in a rural Wisconsin hospital. So,
yeah.
That could be scary.
And
so you chose to stay in relatively mild climes of Southern California. Or actually, you live in the Bay Area, is that right?
No, I live in Southern California.
Southern California, that's right.
And we've been having not so mild weather for us, quite chilly and windy. I mean, we've actually gone all the way down to 40. Oh, my God. Get out the parka. But compared to one of the places they were was Minneapolis, where it was zero, I think I'm doing pretty well here.
Yeah, it probably was wise that you stayed, but it not a good time of the year to be alone. That's not any fun.
No, and a new feeling. I've never been alone for the holidays before, especially since I do have a family with kids and have gone through all the same things you were.
Yeah.
I probably got sick because running around and having to find the gifts and do this and do that. And
it can be exhausting, can it? Getting ready for the holiday.
Well, and all of the concerts and the presentations,
right,
and the projects that they have due at the end of the semester, and December. Do you guys have jobs? I mean, I don't know how anybody does it.
Yeah.
It can be very tricky.
Time management is a big thing in December, seems like. But the worst of that's beyond us, and New Year's the fun time. So, yeah, I'm glad to have that much done.
Yeah, have all the hustle and bustle behind us. Well, I can tell you, I can definitely commiserate with the pneumonia thing. I had that a few years ago when I was living overseas, and caught it. Well, I don't know if you catch it. I don't know how you get pneumonia, but I was living in Malaysia, and at the time there was this process going on the island of Borneo. They were burning the peat bogs, and this unbelievable haze had settled over the city, and everybody was just like wearing surgical masks around and stuff. And I don't know. I guess I spent one or too many days out walking in it, and I ended up contracting pneumonia and spent about 2 weeks in bed just feeling really sick. So.
Yeah.
It's a bad deal.
I
guess where I was going with that was pneumonia, a bad deal.
Yeah.
Amen.
All right. Hey, no arguments, Phil.
But it sounds like for you, PJ, at least you got to finally get some rest.
Definitely got rest. Tried to do some work, although my laptop in bed ate my revisions on my book, so naughty laptop. I almost threw it out the window. But other than that, we're good.
Well, I can tell a laptop story too, but I'm gonna hold off on that. Actually, that can circle through on the holiday stuff. One thing I wanted to check in with you on, Stephen, is tell us about LSU versus Ohio State. What's going on with that?
Well, on January the 7th, there's a big bowl game down in New Orleans, and they're playing for the national championship, LSU versus Ohio State. And so you know where I'll be on January the 7th. I won't be in New Orleans.
Yeah.
I'll be watching it on my TV. I'll be in my living room enjoying the game. But I'm excited about that. There was a time not too long ago, like a couple of weeks ago, that I was sure that they were out of the running, but it worked out that they won just the right number of times against the right teams, and then some teams that weren't expected to lose lost, and so it just was fortunate they're going to be in the bowl game. So anyway, that's
kind of like the Rockies.
Yeah,
they went through that incredible experience getting into the World Series. But let's hope.
Let's stop our discussion at the World Series.
LSU's experience at the bowl will be better than the Rockies.
Oh well, you know. It's an honor that the Rockies made it as far as they did, and LSU feels honored, I'm sure, now. But they want to win the game, obviously. So
okay, well, go Tigers.
Yeah, that's right.
And whoever's playing New England in the first playoff game. But we don't want to start all that stuff, so we'll shy away from the NFL, I think, at this point. Living in Denver, there's really not an awful lot to talk about the NFL anyway. So we'll just keep moving along. We got a lot to talk about. Yeah, I did want to give one post-holiday laptop story here. And I don't know if you guys have ever encountered anything like this. I mean, PJ, you were talking about yours died on you, you said. Was it the hard disk went out, or what happened?
I'm still trying to figure out exactly what happened, but because our wireless network, we have a server set up. For some reason, it was the software was asking me to save it in a way that it never asked to be saved before. It seemed suspicious to me, but I went along with it. That was probably my biggest mistake. And somehow all those automatically saved revisions disappeared down a rabbit hole I now can't find.
Oh.
And I thought I've looked under every rock. So I
would encourage you to get a computer technician to look at that. There might be something that's retrievable there that you just don't know how to get to.
Right.
Probably the case.
I would hope. You know,
probably right.
Keep your fingers crossed on that.
But
have you ever noticed, though, that when you the laptop goes out, the hard drive crashes or whatever, that within your mind, whatever it was that you were working on was it becomes the great American novel, or whatever it is that you lost is priceless and irretrievable for all time.
Oh, absolutely. Well, in fact, what happened is for Christmas I got this beautiful new Sony Vaio laptop that I'm just completely in love with and very excited about. And my big problem here is with Vista, I was able to easily move all my settings over, but I can't move my applications over. So I'm looking for, well, how do I get all my programs over onto the new computer? You know, this is always this problem. And I'm thinking, well, I don't have all the installed disks anymore. I don't have the serial numbers anymore. This is how they make you buy new software, right? It's like,
right.
I don't have a good way of doing this. But I actually do, because I have drive clone software. I've actually had the back off this thing and put new hard disks into my old laptop before. So I'm like, by my terms, kind of a computer wizard here, right? Because I can actually take a hard disk off and put another one in and, you know, make a backup clone drive and back it up on. And so I think I'm pretty brilliant.
He's bragging now, PJ.
Well,
I can tell.
But pride goeth before you know what. So I get this thing, I get the clone made, and I'm like, well, I don't know. I don't really want to, you know, Vista, this computer has all this cool stuff on it. So I clone that, too. I've got two external hard disks. I'm like, I'm cloning everything, right? I'll clone what's on the new one. I'll clone what's on the old one. I'm going to copy the clone of the old one onto the new one and run all my programs and everything on the old one, and then maybe slowly but surely copy stuff from the backup of the new one, blah, blah, blah. So somewhere in the process of all that brilliance, the backup of every image that I've ever put on the Speculist got erased. Okay,
oh, God.
So it's like my whole graphics file for like what have we got? 4+ years, 5 years.
Yeah.
However long we've been doing
it. I think you started and I joined you about 3 or 4 months after that in 2004.
Yeah,
I
started in 2000. Did I start in 2004 or 2003?
Yeah. Well, I think you actually had a couple of A couple of test posts up in late 2003. That's right.
Yeah, actually, I think so.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a lot of graphics, and they're all gone. Of course, they're not really gone because they're still up on the site. But it's like this was my local copy of all of those. You know.
But I have a question that doesn't make any sense to me. Don't you have backup?
Well, that's a good question, PJ. Actually, as a matter of fact, I cloned over my backup. That was the thing. I had outgrown this hard disk, so I was keeping some of these files on this external disk. And then I got, you know, mucking around with external disks and like, well, here, I'll put a clone here, I'll put a clone there. And it's like, oh, do you want to erase all that? I'm like, yeah, I can erase all that. And then I go downstairs and I'm watching TV and I go, no, not all that.
And you rush back upstairs.
Yeah, it's like 2 hours later. You know, I'm watching The Good Shepherd. I'm about 2 hours into a three-hour movie. When I realize what I've done, I come back up. And of course, it's
gone.
Oh,
man.
You know, it's where you want the AI. You want it to go, wait, you mean, you're sure you want it? Do you know what this is? Do you realize what you're...
There's an odd synchronicity here. I was watching The Good Shepherd when my material went down.
Oh, when your laptop went down? And this is weird. Yeah,
isn't,
this is a movie about CIA and all sorts of covert things. I'm
absolutely.
Weird.
Tricks, and counterintelligence. Absolutely.
And don't you do Tales of the Paranormal?
Yeah, that's right.
I think we... Stephen, can you?
Let's see. Oh, I'm slow on it tonight, guys. I was not anywhere close to having it.
That's okay. We're still talking.
Okay.
Find it. Hit it.
Oh, slowly but surely.
Okay, we'll have to watch it. The odd link between...
Good Shepherd.
Good Shepherd. I had to remember. People's laptops crashing. How bizarre.
Wow. Oh,
wow. Lost files and the Good Shepherd. Man, that's good instincts there, PJ, for...
Bringing that up. Well, I tell you, I haven't seen the movie. I heard it's great, but I'm not going to do anything with my laptop the day prior to watching it.
I would go see it in a friend's house.
Let his laptop crash.
That's what I would recommend.
Yeah, that's great.
I actually can recommend it. I was impressed. What do you think, Phil?
Oh, yeah, I thought it was really cool. I
thought it was very accurate, surprisingly accurate, of how that world worked, the kinds of guys that were attracted to it, the development of the CIA. I thought it was quite good in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, historically, I don't know any of that, so...
That was my question. Is it going to be accurate?
I'll take their word for it that it's accurate, but to me, it's astounding to think that basically a college fraternity has been kind of setting our intelligence policy for our country. I guess pretty much running our country, it looks like. Basically.
I was going to say, given who's in the White House right now, I'd say still running our country.
Right.
Skull and Bones.
Yeah, but Kerry won. He was a member, too. I mean,
that's right.
That's how they're playing it, right? They've got...
They got both sides, yes. Well, so
we got laptops shutting down, and we got paranoid conspiracy theories going on.
Oh, we're awesome tonight. Hey, PJ, have you seen Beowulf? That's a movie that we had meant to talk about, and Phil finally got around to seeing it, but...
No, unfortunately, I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. Well, I thought we might get into that a little bit. Well, I was going to ask you, Phil, do you think it's a better movie than the original poem, as far as the story goes?
Do I think Beowulf is a better movie than the original poem is a poem?
Okay. The original poem, obviously, is the old English-type version of the story. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And my question is, they've made some changes to the story to make a movie out of it. And I actually thought that the changes to the story might have made it a better story, which is saying a lot when you're talking about something that's like, what, 1,000 years old?
Yeah, well, I think as consumers of entertainment, right, what they did with Beowulf was they were as true to the original narrative as they could possibly be and yet added this whole other dimension of a story. So I thought that, for PJ's
sake and for the sake of our audience, we probably should tell a little bit about it.
Let's give it all away.
Well, minor spoiler warnings. For those of you who want to see it, you know, without any spoiler warnings, you might want to turn your radio down or shoot your speakers down just for a second.
For one thing, if you've seen the trailer, you know that Angelina Jolie plays Grendel's mother.
Yeah, which...
And if you've read the poem, you know that in the poem, Grendel's mother was not originally hot. Okay.
Yeah.
So
far from it, she was a monstrous beast, but obviously Angelina Jolie is not a monstrous beast.
Brings in a lot more box office gentlemen than a monstrous beast does.
Well, yeah, there you go. Exactly. And you're not going to waste an opportunity like that. You're not going to have an animated version of Angelina Jolie walking around essentially naked for all of her scenes and not have anything develop between her and some of the other characters without saying who or what that means. But
yeah,
it just goes without saying that that's going to happen.
Well, it's just, there's sort of this Oedipal thing going on because of that relationship, and it's a more compelling story because of it, and the power of seduction and evil to seduce and all this. I mean, the power of evil to seduce good people to do bad things. I just thought it was made as a good story, and it was made it even more interesting than
that. It definitely added a dimension, I thought.
Yeah.
Sure.
Anyway, I feel like if we go too much further in talking about it, we'd give too much away for those who want to see it. So,
well, I just saw a movie I still haven't gotten to see, I Am Legend, which I was hoping that we'd finally get to talk about. Steven, have you seen it?
I have not. And
PJ, you've seen it.
Yes.
Yes. And did you recommend it highly, or were you on the fence about it?
It was a middling.
Yeah.
I would give it a middling review.
Well, that's almost disappointing after the huge build-up in 10 years in development.
Yeah.
that movie's been around forever. Trying to get it made.
Oh, absolutely, and it's the fourth one of them.
But I'm sure PJ, you can tell you that sometimes they tell us that the longer they take, the better they ain't, right? I mean, that doesn't.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the amount of people involved in the making of that movie, it definitely. The more people involved, the less quality is usually how it works.
Hmm. That's a shame. Well, but it was compelling at times, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. There were sequences that were fantastic. Will Smith is marvelous. The dog is awesome. Seriously, no joke. If they could give awards to dogs, they should give one to this one. And there are aspects of it that are wonderful, but I had a huge problem with not just the conception of the creatures, the altered humans, who are now like this vampiric species, but also their physicality, the CGI of them was awful.
Yeah.
And really no excuse.
When you say it was awful, you mean like you didn't buy it?
They made him cheesy.
Oh, uh-huh.
They just looked cheesy. And there were these moments where, because New York is gone back to the wild, and you assume that animals have left the zoos and have, migrated back down from the mountains north of the city, et cetera. So he's stalking in the high grass of Times Square deer, and these lions appear who you can only assume have come out of either Central Park or the Bronx Zoo.
Right.
And they didn't need to CGI completely these lions. They could have absolutely blue-screened these lions. But no, they actually, constructed them with computer graphics, and they just don't look right.
They look like fake lions.
They look like fake lions. Who needs a fake lion? They didn't have to have a fake lion.
Yeah.
In the old days, they used real lions, and it looked good.
Well, we know what lions look like, and we know what people look like, and so when you CGI those things,
it's the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
If you're messing with reality as we know it, you either have to make it flawless or you have to make it so not reality that the audience can safely, the Gollum is a perfect example of that. I mean, Gollum is an exquisite character,
right,
when it comes to CGI, partially because he doesn't look human, but he's just human enough to gain our empathy,
right,
but he's not so human that we sort of pick him apart.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I thought was interesting about Beowulf, and I think you had mentioned this, Stephen, was that they seem to have made it to the other side of the uncanny valley with that one. Because
at times,
characters, you just feel like you're watching a movie. I mean, it's just like there's Anthony Hopkins on screen. You don't feel like you're watching a CGI of him necessarily. Right?
That's right, and there's no shots in the entire movie of Beowulf that were shot with a camera, They didn't go to Scandinavia and shoot, film for this movie. All of it, every bit of it was CGI, the entire movie. But they did so well that at times you forget that you're watching animation. It looked photorealistic at times. you know, obviously the points that we had a problem with that is probably the close-ups where the people are talking to one another, and it's, you know, that just it's really, really hard to make that work, you know. So
it's facial micro movements. It's also the eyes. Eyes are one of the hardest things to get.
They look dead sometimes, or they look like they're blind or something. They're not; the eyes are not focusing in ways that you would expect living eyes to focus. And yeah, that's a problem. I remember it was Polar Express. They tried to do something similar with that, but it was the eyes and some of the facial movements were the real problems that they had trouble picking up. So.
Yeah, I was just watching the Polar Express the other day, and I was thinking about that criticism had been leveled against that movie, and you can really see it in scenes. There are times when you just are kind of jarred away from the story, which is a wonderful story. I mean, it's a great book, right? It's a great children's
book. My kids' favorite books, yeah.
Yeah, I love that book. I love the end. You get spoiler warning here, okay? You get to that last line of the book, and I remember the first time I read that to my daughter, I literally got choked up when I got to that last line of the book. So this is, and just a beautiful design, just a beautiful book, and really ambitious to make that into a movie, but where it kind of falls down a few times is when you're watching it and suddenly you're going, what? Dude, that little girl looks kind of creepy, you know?
Well, they get that demonic thing going. It's
exactly,
kind of,
yeah. I don't trust that little
girl.
Yeah, you know? And it kind of ruins. And then you like her again, of course, but, you know.
Well, you know, I suppose a good thing is that, you know, in 20 years they can do an update. You know, they'll do something like what they did with the Star Wars movies, but this time it'll actually will be better.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting idea. They might do that. So listen, while we're on the topic of movies, let's keep our year in review theme here a little bit. So what was our top speculist choice of movies for 2007? Anybody have a particular title or titles that are particular high quality movies that deal with our kinds of topics, or were there any this year? I'm actually racking my brain now, trying to think.
I'm trying to rack my brain too, and I'm not coming up too well.
Huh? Yeah.
Last year, I mean, to me, still, Children of Men is got to go a long, long way to surpass that. That has got to be one of the best movies of this kind of subject matter made.
Oh yes,
I agree. I wrote a review of that for the Speculist.
There's 20 minutes near the end of that movie that just absolutely blows me away.
Oh yeah.
As far as the amount of realistic violence, wartime realistic violence, nothing touches it except for maybe Saving Private Ryan.
And that single shot, the fact that single tracking shot that he does, he goes into the building and around the building and through the building and out of the building, and it's one uninterrupted shot.
I have no idea how they did that.
From a technical standpoint, I remember watching the theater, and both my husband and I, our jaws went slack. At the same time, we sort of looked at each other at the corner of our eyes and laughed because we couldn't believe it. It was, I can only imagine the unbelievable amount of rehearsals. It must have taken days to rehearse that.
You would think.
And how do you do that without injuring your actors? I just don't understand how they managed to do that, because, you know, sure, bullets aren't really flying, but
you got
explosive charges everywhere,
right?
To do what they did, and how do you keep from putting cement in his eye or something? You know, I mean, to me, it was incredible.
Well, what really made that movie work for me, I mean, in addition to the fact, just good performances and technically brilliant movie making, and I'm not a big dystopian guy, I got to say. You know, if you're gonna give me a dystopian future, I'm gonna prefer a cheesy one like I Am Legend, because
right.
I think those are more entertaining, and because I tend to go with the future will be a good place, future will be a fun thing, but kind of view of the world. But in the middle of that combat that you were describing, Stephen, and it's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking, man, this is as intense as Saving Private Ryan. That's exactly what I was thinking when I was watching it. It's like Normandy Beach, that sequence.
Yeah.
Like, you're almost reliving that. In the middle of that, and I don't want to spoil the end of the movie for anybody who's not watching, so I won't say exactly what it is, everything stops out of reverence for human life.
Yeah.
In this one just moment where, you know, it all stops because suddenly nobody wants to fight for a minute.
Yeah.
And that is just one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And what really was great was I totally bought it.
Oh yeah, because the whole movie had built it up to that point.
It was a
payoff that was much deserved.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
And it reminded me. I mean, it was a nativity moment. You know, it was definitely Joseph, Mary, you know, Jesus, in the manger kind of moment. But it was awesome. It was awesome.
Yeah, that's a gripping moment. So our best movie of 2007 was actually from 2006.
Right?
Yeah, we're still so blown away that we can't think of anything.
Well,
else.
Was it this year? Was the Emma Thompson, Will Ferrell, She's Writing His Life movie? Was that this year or was that last year?
That was this year, I think.
Yeah,
okay.
That was this year. Earlier this year,
I would count that one as a speculist contender.
I had an opportunity to watch that on cable in bed this week as well, and I missed it. So now you're telling me I have to actually watch it.
Oh yeah, you want to watch?
It's not your typical Will Ferrell movie.
It's really not. You know,
yeah.
Well, I just watched Elf the other day. Speaking of non-typical Will Ferrell movies, but it's a very different, very very different kind of role for him, and it deals with this whole question of what's real and what layer of reality are we experiencing? What level of reality are we experiencing? Of course, we talk about this notion that the universe we live in might actually be a simulation.
Mm, yeah.
Well, this movie isn't specifically dealing with that, but it does to the extent that...
Well, it's the literary simulation.
Right.
That's the idea.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Artists,
right.
Artists are the original creators of simulated universes. They did it before... I mean, that's where it all started, right? A novelist creates a simulated world, right? And it's just that in this story, somehow the world she's created and the world she's living in have somehow oddly overlapped, and it's to great comedic effect, and yet to more serious effect as you get a little bit deeper into the story. I thought it was
there's a little glitch in the universe, I guess, and that's how it happened, huh?
One of those glitches.
A little glitch in the simulation,
right? Yeah,
yeah.
Isn't that in the Matrix? They say when you have deja vu, that's a
it's a glitch.
A
yeah,
glitch in the source code. Something hit a little bug there. But what reminded me of that is I saw a movie over the weekend, which would not typically come to the top of the list of speculist type movies. But have either of you seen Atonement?
No.
I have not. No.
Okay, so I don't want to give anything away. But
we're giving not much away at all.
I don't want to give anything away except to say that Atonement deals with some of those same kinds of issues in its own very very different sort of way. So I don't want to.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to seeing that. That's one of the things at the top of my list.
Well, I think you'll enjoy it. PJ, have you ever read Doris Lessig? Have you ever read The Golden Notebook by any chance?
No, I haven't.
Because that was the book it really. Brought to mind, and now I would talk about the trick that Lessig pulls in The Golden Notebook, but if I talk about that, then I'll give away what happens in Atonement, so I'm not going to talk about it. But
okay, well, I just know to go see it. Phil, what I want to, if it's okay, I want to switch gears. What do you think is the biggest tech story of the year? I mean, if you had to just choose one,
if I'm going to choose one.
I'll open it up to you too, PJ.
If we can do it by categories, that's going to be easier. But
yeah, I agree.
I would say that...
yeah, pick a category and go with the biggest one.
Okay, well, I'm gonna go ahead and spoil the suspense on my new Better All the Time coming out. My number one story that I picked for the year was, and it's also one of our finer moments on Fast Forward Radio, was Dr. Jing Sui and the work that he's doing fighting cancer using the immune system. And I guess actually probably the real breakthrough and the real story is yet to come when he completes his human trial. But for me, the progress that he has made is just one of the biggest stories of not just here, but of all time.
And I don't think anyone is any more surprised about it than Dr. Sui.
Well, exactly. That's one of the things that made the whole thing so interesting was just talking to him about the experience he went through in finding himself in this position of being the guy who's curing cancer, who had no expectation of ever being that guy. It's just an amazing story, and I would pick that one as the one that stands out in my mind the most.
Well, you know, I'm just blown away by what he's done, and hope that you know, that it turns out as promising as what he's done so far. But I mean, I guess we should kind of review real quick what he has accomplished so far.
Well, today,
he's done it in mice, and now he's doing human trials. Is that right?
That's right. Today, what he has done is he has bred a strain of cancer-proof mice who can't get cancer, who if you inject them full of cancer such that it would kill a normal mouse, they just brush it off and they don't have cancer anymore. But more importantly, if you give a normal mouse who has cancer a transfusion from these mice, their cancer is cured. He's taken that same principle, applied it to human white blood cells.
And he's basically, he's found some people that fight off cancer.
He has, in fact, identified, some strains of, I can't think of the word now, but it's within the white blood cells that are resistant to cancer along the same lines that that the cancer-proof mice are, not to the same extent. It's not as dramatic and clear-cut a absolutely cancer-proof as it is with the mice. But in-test tube has now demonstrated that these immune cells will kill cancer.
Right.
So the test that he's working on doing now will be transfusions into from subjects who seem to have this immunity to cancer to cancer patients who with various types to see if the effect will work with human beings the way it has with mice. So
that would be remarkable.
Oh yeah,
absolutely. It's going to be huge. We're fingers crossed on that one.
Well, I can't argue with that. I think that's as far as biotech goes, that's the big story this year. There's another one that comes in a close second, and that is the story of taking human skin cells and making basically embryonic stem cells.
That's what I would have said as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And that development, I mean, obviously that renders the whole problem of the shortage of embryonic stem cells, provided that they can, it comes to fruition the way we hope, then, obviously we'll have all the embryonic stem cells we need, and there won't be any reason to argue against it.
Well, the problem becomes, of course, if in fact it performs in the same way that the embryonic stem cells have. I was actually going to say stem cell research in general, because there's been a lot of amazing research this year that's come out with specific organ replacement, where they've been putting cells within two organs, tissue systems, and it's grown into heart muscle, liver muscle, et cetera. Not liver muscle, of course, what am I saying? Liver tissue, et cetera. That I've to sort of put it all together, and all the fronts that they've been developing in regards to stem cells has been extraordinary. This year has just been unbelievably fruitful, but I do hesitate to say that this is going to be the thing that stops us from using embryonic stem cells, because I don't know if we know enough about that yet. Don't know if we know enough that these stem cells can do all the same things that embryonic stem cells can do.
And I hear that same caution with the scientists. They want this to be the answer to this problem, really. But at the same time, they don't want to say, "Okay, well, everybody can relax now."
Exactly.
We've solved it. This is the sort of thing that's already been duplicated in more than one lab. It's not just one little isolated case, and so I'm hopeful that this solves that problem, and we can get on with our testing. We'll have enough embryonic stem cell lines to do the testing that we need to do. And so,
well, it will be very exciting to see where this goes, and to see if it does pan out. The reason potentially that this could be, if these cells turn out to be, the technical term is pluripotent. Is that right?
Yes,
that's right.
Pluripotent cells that function the same as, or essentially are the same as, embryonic cells. Of course, the big step forward here is that everybody gets their own, right? You don't have to worry about a genetic match. You would have your own stem cells that would be used in your own treatment. I think that's just an enormous step forward in stem cell treatment generally.
Yes, exactly.
It's
Well, Matt comments here in the chat room, our friend Matt comments saying that, you know, this is approaching in real life what Dr. Wang claimed to do back in 2004,
it's
which
true.
Turned out to be a big lie. But, yeah, that's I think one of the reasons that we believed it, and I say we, I mean everybody believed that he had accomplished it, was because...
Yeah, but especially you.
Yeah, especially me. Yeah, I was the big dope. But of all the, you know, the reason we believed it is because we knew it was getting close. These developments were coming along, and so why not him in South Korea? Well, it just turned out not to be true, but which is a shame.
But you get these false duns sometimes, and then
the real thing
starts
happens.
To show up. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, other fronts. What are some of the other big developments that have occurred this year out of biotech? Some of the other areas that we look at.
Well, I'm big on energy, and we had a great. I wasn't part of that show, Phil, but you got to talk to Dr. Zubrin about energy. And
right. Well, if we're doing a recap of best of Fast Forward Radio, that was definitely one of our finest hours. I think that, you know, that first show with PJ was probably our best show.
Yeah, that's no doubt.
Oh,
she's not going to let us just.
Top three would have to be PJ, Dr. Sweet.
No log rolling allowed, guys.
And Robert Zubrin.
Well, we had a lot of fun, though, PJ, and we're glad that you had as much fun, and that's why you're back with us.
Exactly,
yeah,
likewise.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very exciting. Very exciting time with Dr. Zubrin. You know, I had him on the show primarily because I'm so interested in his ideas about Mars, and so it's like, okay, hey, sure, I'll read your book. Let's have you on the show. Thinking, well, we'll get him off this energy kick, and we can maybe talk a little bit of Mars. And of course,
I don't think the word Mars was mentioned.
When I introduced him, I said Mars Society. I mentioned that.
That was it.
That was as far as it got because there was just so much to be said on his ideas about what we can do to break our dependence on imported oil, to break our dependence on oil generally, to introduce new means, new technologies for powering vehicles. This is where it gets really exciting for me, to open up markets for third world agricultural products. It's really an astounding vision that he presents in his book. It's just it's just one of the more exciting sets of ideas that I've come across in some time. And the beauty of it is that it hinges upon using a known technology, which is flex fuel technology, and applying it. To new vehicles that are built in this country that are sold in this country that are built elsewhere, and it's you know, compared to just about everything else we talk about, this is an extremely simple thing to implement. It would, you know, I mean, there would be some overhead involved, but compared to almost anything else we talk about, this would be one of the easiest things that could be done, and yet it could make a tremendous difference for us.
Right. And flex fuel, what kind of fuel would you use? I mean, you could obviously still use gasoline.
Yeah, well, the beauty of the flex fuel system is that you can drive a flex fuel vehicle up to a pump, and it doesn't matter what you've currently got in your tank, and it doesn't matter of these three things, gasoline, methanol, or ethanol, it doesn't matter what that pump's putting out. It can be
That's brilliant.
One of those three things or any combination of them. And if you've got, say, you've been running gas in your tank, and it's half empty, or half full, excuse me, this is the speculist half full. you drive up to a tank that's pumping methanol. You pump the methanol in there. Now you've got a tank that's half gasoline, half methanol. A flex fuel car will drive with that just fine.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I love the idea that you can take biomass and garbage and all the rest and turn it into fuel. I think that's fantastic, getting rid of what we would normally use as waste.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and in fact, that one applies. You know, there are definitely ways to move towards ethanol and methanol with that, but the really exciting biomass application, I think, is going to be biodiesel. And, Stephen, you were writing about that just this week, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Biodiesel is exciting because we can grow our own, you know, and it's also diesel engines have gotten so much cleaner and more efficient. You get like 74 miles to the gallon now with these new VW diesels that they're selling in Europe now. 74 miles to the gallon of diesel, and they say because you go so far on a single gallon of diesel, it's putting out less greenhouse gas per mile than a hybrid Prius that's running on gasoline.
Wow,
and
that's
so
amazing.
And my thought is, well, that's great. Okay, now what we do is we take that super clean diesel engine and make a hybrid out of it, and then while we're at it, let's get the batteries that it requires to make it a plug-in, so we can run off the grid. We're running with diesel fuel that perhaps we're growing ourselves, biodiesel, and they're so clean that they're not putting out much greenhouse gas, and you're getting 74 miles to the gallon when you're not using electricity. That would be probably about as clean as you could possibly get.
Mm-hmm.
And in your daily commuting, you might not even engage the diesel engine, you know?
Absolutely. Well, and the great thing is there, a vehicle that burns diesel will burn either standard or bio. Is that right?
That's right. That's absolutely right.
So you have this option of, you know, if biodiesel is available, you can pump that in. If it's not, then you can use regular diesel fuel. Just the idea of having choices is huge. And we really haven't had that for powering our cars ever in our lifetimes. And it's something that you just sort of see people kind of waking up now and going, you know, why aren't there like multiple ways of doing this? And why don't we get a choice? You know, I mean, you think about you have a choice of whether you're going to have satellite or cable, right? You know, what kind of phone system you're going to, you know, what kind of computer. You know, there's always multiple choices for everything. But we're very tied into one way of powering our vehicles. And what's exciting about these kinds of ideas, you take a diesel hybrid, and suddenly, well, the fuel can be this kind of diesel or it can be that kind of diesel. And if you're running off the grid, that power can come from a lot of different sources. So suddenly, a whole lot of choices have been introduced where there were none before.
Well, I love how also the other choices are becoming, because things are becoming cheaper. You've got the whole idea, you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but we sold our house this year with plans to buy another house here in our town to either greenovate the house or to build a green, eco-friendly, sustainable house. And I live in a community that is filled with sun and filled with wind.
Yeah.
We have more sun and wind than we know what to do with. And it's ludicrous that this entire town isn't run on solar and wind power.
Yeah.
Finally, people are manufacturing solar panels at a cost where we can actually start installing them and justify it relatively early in the process, as opposed to saying, well, you know, 10 down years down the line, I'll have broken even.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. When solar gets to the point where, and it apparently just now this year, this is a big, huge thing. Solar has gotten to the point.
That's why I bring it up, exactly.
Yeah, just this year. And really, within the last couple of months, they've started selling solar panels that are cheap enough that they compare favorably with grid power, and so that you don't even have to be particularly green, to think that's great. The green you could be concerned about is money, you know, and still want to install these things on top of your house. So that's awesome that we've reached that point.
Well, and the state of California, I don't know if you guys know this, passed this thing called the Solar House Initiative, where they hope by 2010. To have installed 1 million solar systems in 1 million homes. And this includes new buildings. And it was fought vociferously by the development lobby, who didn't want to have to build homes with solar units. What they discovered is once they started building them, even in these enormous communities, you know, built by the KB Homes and Eli Broad and things like this, these houses were going for premium. People were willing to pay in this market. In this downhill real estate market, people are willing to pay more money for solar homes.
You know, and that should be logical, because you see that what people will pay for a hybrid compared to the same amount of functionality you can get from a car and pay a lot less for one that doesn't have electricity involved. But
and it's not
everything's hindsight, I guess.
Oh, actually, and what's fascinating, though, is these are homes that I would say these are classic middle-class homes. These are not... you know, for many people, the whole hybrid phenomenon was something that for some people it seemed relegated to those who could afford to be green. You know, green was seen as something that, well, you know, you're rich, you can do this.
Right.
The point is to make it not about being rich or not rich. The point is that it should be at the same price so that it's an available option. You know, people need these options.
Absolutely.
My brother, I got to get him on this program. He is a home builder, and he has found that in this down market that green sells. And he says you have to show good judgment in what you put into a home. You could make the greenest home in the world, but it would cost $1 million and nobody would buy it. And so you have to make the right decisions. And so he double pane windows, obviously. He's using the most up to date insulation, you know, the high and also he's using tankless water heaters. He says it's amazing how much energy you can save with that.
I had those when I lived in New Zealand for 7 years, and they were the greatest invention. When we first moved back to the States in 2000, we were renovating a house then, and I was trying to find one. For love nor money, I could not find one. And last year I went to the Greenhouse Expo. The city of Santa Monica every year does it specifically for architects and builders. It's really not meant for the general public, to encourage them to use green materials. And I practically danced down the aisle when I saw three different companies who now have the tankless water heaters. They're genius.
Well, you can run your hot water forever, and it's not, and as long as you want hot water, you got it. You never run out of hot water.
It's Insta-hot. It's fantastic.
But you're not sitting there heating water that you're not using
exactly.
At 3 in the morning.
Exactly. And
think about this. You can't run out of hot water.
That's right.
And even though you won't run out of hot water, you're still going to be saving energy. I mean, this is the ultimate technological win-win.
And
that's
in
right.
Earthquake country like where I live in, you don't have the issue of, oh my God, you know, strapping your water heater down, and you know, you practically have to have an entire seismic room for your water heater nowadays, because of course, you know, the gas lines and everything else, but and the problems of leaking water heaters. So all of that, it disappears.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful technology, and you save a lot of money that way. And so, yeah, he's got this smorgasbord of things that he does, and he's weighed it a number of ways, and to the point that he's got it kind of down to it's both art and science to build the right amount of green into a home that it'll sell, but you know, and it sells at a premium too.
Well, but it sounds like the point is get him out there to Southern California, and they'll buy him with the full $1 million package.
That's right. He could probably make a whole lot more money out there.
Hey, can
sure.
I talk to your brother?
Yeah, we'll get him on the line with you sometime. That's right.
Yeah, if he's listening, I think he'd be interested in hearing about what's going on out there.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he would. How is the real estate market holding up out there? Because, I mean, this is really a national, you know, the real estate market has gone down nationally. I guess it's California.
If you're talking about statewide, we're definitely having serious problems. But there are, of course, regions which are buffered. Northern California, the Bay Area, is definitely got a buffer compared to, I think, the rest of the state. And traditionally, areas like my community are pretty buffered. It's considered, you know, a very affluent community, but even then, finally, suddenly, it's the market here is really softening. Of course, the fires didn't help.
Yeah, right.
So the perception that this is a dangerous place to live definitely makes things a little dried up.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, we have we had an enormous real estate bubble here. When
yeah.
you really look back at it, the prices compared to what people make, compared to their incomes, the housing prices just really, truly, regardless of the nationwide, I don't know how it could have been sustained because who could live here?
Yeah.
Right.
That nobody could afford to live in California the way things were going, huh?
Right. You know, and forget about, you know, our taxes and everything else. That's a whole other story. But
yeah.
But given, you know, given real estate prices, I don't know how it could have been sustained.
Well, I guess if there's any good news at all that come out of the bubble popping is that, you know, once again, it might be affordable to come to Southern California. You know,
you're right.
You know, I mean,
now that's the bright side.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it. There it is. Normal people might one day be able to afford to move there.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's great.
Or, you know, maybe people can go back, you know, because we had a huge influx of Californians into Colorado for precisely that reason. I think the cost of living got so high, but, you know, real estate and other things, that you had this huge influx. This was probably more in the late 90s, in the early part of the 21st century, and just this constant barrage of Californians moving into the Denver area. And you know what they did? They shot our real estate prices up, too, so that's interesting. Now that they all move back to California, we'll have some kind of double rebound crash. But hey, these are kind of pessimistic thoughts.
My question is: did you have signs up to say Californians go home, like the people in Oregon have?
No, I mean there are people who do that, but I wasn't born in this state, so I don't feel that I'm entitled. My daughter was, but I wasn't, so I don't feel that I'm entitled to take that kind of stand. Nor would I. Some of my best friends are from California.
Yeah, that's right.
I feel better now, thank you.
Yeah. So let's look ahead now. Let's talk about 2008. Let's talk about 2009. Let's talk about 2029. What do we see coming in the next year? What are we looking for? Big development that you'd like to see happen in the next year, or just any big development that you're looking for in the next 10 years, next 20 years, And Stephen, not to put you on the spot, we'll start with you. Go.
Okay. Not to put me on the spot. Well, I'm really excited about the energy future, and I Phil, I don't know if you buy into peak oil or not, but I think that there is a certain amount of oil on this planet, and that eventually it will, you know, we'll use it.
Right.
At least the oil that we can access, we can get to, and you know, at what point does, you know, do we start having a problem, you know, moving around? Well, I think that, you know, the Stone Age is over, but it's not for lack of stone, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we just move on to better things, and I think that we're beginning to see glimmers of some of these better things. And I think for long-distance traveling, we're going to use liquid fuel of some kind or another, but I think we're going to grow a lot of it. And for short distance traveling, I think we're going to be electric. I think that's going to happen in a short period of time. And I think the things that are going to enable that are going to be things like cheap solar cells that we can either put on the roofs of our houses or garages, or even on the cars themselves, that will you know, produce enough power at a low enough cost that it makes it worthwhile. And going to be batteries or capacitors or, you know, other ways of storing that energy to go down the highway with. That's, you know, I see that as a big, big deal. The ability to get around and move things around ourselves and goods and service, you know, things like that. That's extremely important to our economy and to the world economy. And so the ability to do those things is extremely important. And so. I think we're going to find ways of doing it, and that are going to be cheaper and cleaner than what we've been doing. And so I'm excited about that. So I guess that's
these portable nukes we talked about, the Hyperion type ideas, one of the better all the time pieces that'll be showing up in that.
I hope we start seeing that.
When do you think we'll see one of those showing up somewhere?
Well, I think they've already started shipping some, and I think what you're going to see is like the first places they're going to try this thing is probably remote sites, some place where they're, you know, trying to extract oil or something like that out in the middle of nowhere, and then they need electrical power. Well, they'll try this, you know. And when it works out well, then they'll try to other places. I'd love to see, you know, PJ, picking on your state, I'd love to see California, because you guys are willing to try new things, you know. You know, to have some test communities and see if this, how well this works. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if the green guys will buy that out in your state, but it's...
Yeah, I have a hard time picturing California jumping on they like to try new things. I don't know if they want to try new nuclear things.
Yeah, we do have issues with nuclear power already.
Yeah.
It's quite politically divisive. So I'm
maybe we'll try Nevada first.
There you go. Now they'll really try anything.
Well, they're willing to try. I mean, they're already, you know, all nuclear and irradiated anyway. So.
Yeah, exactly. They're already toasted. They need the power. You know, Of course, they got Hoover Dam right there, so I don't know how much they
have. I think most of that power gets shipped to California.
Well, there you go.
And so maybe they can ship that power to California and try nukes for their home power needs.
You mentioned peak oil. One thing I did want to pick up on that, one scenario from Zubrin's book. One of the great reasons for going flex fuel is that should peak oil turn out to be a true scenario, and should it happen like next year or in 3 years or something like that, we have the capacity to, it would be fairly straightforward for us to start making methanol out of coal, right? If we were just looking for a stopgap, hey, there's no more oil, until something else kicks in, we've got to power our cars from something.
Yeah.
So it would be great if cars were already set up so that they could run off that. If we actually end up in a situation where that happens,
and
I just wanted to throw that out there.
And it wouldn't take much to just mandate it. All cars are flex fuel, and it wouldn't really all new cars that roll off the assembly lines. It wouldn't be that expensive per car either, according to what Zubrin was saying. Is that right?
That's exactly right. We're talking about a modified fuel injection system. All cars have fuel injection systems now anyway. So it's not like we're saying, hey, you have to have one. Everybody has one now anyway. It's modifications to that, and it's modifications to the fuel line so that it will accept
methanol,
alcohol,
methanol,
which,
yeah.
You know, so that won't eat it up.
Yeah,
actually, it'd be modest even compared to the requirements that the president just signed off on, what was that, week before last.
Yeah.
Even compared to that, it would be a fairly modest set of changes that would have to occur.
It'd be a whole lot cheaper than, say, a driver and passenger side airbags was, and we mandated that. So, to me, that would be a good thing to go ahead and do so that if that bad thing happened, then we'd be ready. I think that's an absolutely great point.
Yeah, I'd like to see that happen. Okay, let me give my scenario now.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm going to stick with my big development for the year, which was cancer, and I wanted to point out another one, which will also be showing up in the new Better All the Time. It was a big story when it showed up, and then it's kind of gone quiet. We haven't heard much about it, but this drug DCA, which is actually patented many years ago, and I think it was for people suffering from some kind of motor coordination problems. It was not developed as a cancer drug, but these initial tests showed it killing just all kinds of different cancers in a petri dish. It's not a patented medicine. There's no patent on it, so it's readily.
Nobody approved. Wants to touch it.
Well, no, it's public domain is the point.
Yeah,
so
the patents have long since expired.
So that the pharmaceuticals can't make any money off of it. Yeah,
exactly. That's your point, right, PJ?
Exactly,
yeah,
right.
There's no money to be made. But
nobody wants to touch it from a business standpoint. Of course,
exactly.
People want to get their hands on it from a medical standpoint. So it'll be slower to implement something like that, or even something like what Dr. Swee is talking about, just because there's kind of a cancer industry in place now. There, you know, we have in the same way that it would be hard to just cure diabetes because there's kind of this diabetes industry in place, and the companies that are making money off that, there's nothing particularly in it for them to
make their market disappear.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, how exactly does this operate? Remind me, because it's been a while since we talked about it.
Well, I'm not sure how it would be delivered. I think it's an injection, but it's a drug called dichloroacetate, and actually what it's been used for is to treat metabolic disorders, but some scientists, I think they were in Australia, started,
Canada.
I don't know why.
Canada, yeah.
Oh, excuse me, Canada. Started applying it to various cancerous tissues and discovering that when you this stuff and cancer just don't mix. It seems to wipe out cancer quite effectively and a lot of different kinds of cancer. So
by one route or another, you know, that's a great hope for the future. By one route or another, cancer is gone in 5 years. How about that?
I don't think it'll be gone. Here's what I think.
Okay.
Give us 5 years, and I think we can see ourselves well on the way to having cancer be something that's handled about the way diabetes is now.
Okay.
You know, it's something
a
where
chronic
you know,
condition that we just deal with.
Yeah, that's bad, but we can work with it. You know, and except for the fact that I think that a lot of it, you know, will be cured as opposed to just dealt with. That'll be
well, and it's also interesting because we still think about cancer as though it's one disease, when in fact it's probably several diseases that manifest in a similar symptom of the overproduction of cells.
That is an excellent point. Yes.
You know, it's the same thing about curing autism. Well, my instinct is that autism is probably has about 20 different starting points, each one of them manifesting in a kind of behavior or kind of mental state. But, you know, they don't all, you can't just cure it from the beginning based on one take. I'm fascinated by the DCA because it really gets down to the cell's metabolic process, and it's such a simple fix, which is what's even more extraordinary about it. But what dismays me is that, because I was fascinated by this, because I have a number of friends who have had cancer or have it presently, and I was doing some research on it, and the university is actually raising money like, you know, fundraising, asking people to send money so they can continue research.
Right.
Because they can't get money any other way.
Exactly. Well, and in fact, when we had Dr. Sui on our show talking about his treatment, it's essentially us saying, hey, if you're listening to this, here's his website. Give him some money.
Write a check.
That's what it's down to. But the upside of both of those is that they are very straightforward and fairly simple to implement, such that if the research pans out, if we can get the research funded and it pans out, they could be made widely available even without sponsorship from a big drug company, if we can get through this hurdle of getting the initial research done.
That's right, exactly. And that just needs money.
To make happen, yeah, for sure. Well, you know what? We are almost out of time, so PJ,
I wanted to throw in another thing.
Okay.
One more area.
All right,
that,
one more, Steve.
One more area that that there's been advances is computer hardware this year.
Okay.
I guess my favorite gadget is probably the iPhone for 2007. Now, it's a bug. Apparently, people have had their problems with them and things like that. But I think that thing is a game changer. Our cell phones will all look very much like that probably in a few years.
Probably in a couple years, we'll all be carrying something that looks like
very much like an iPhone. Yeah.
So that's your prediction. Okay, now PJ gets to give her scenario.
I'm sorry. I just butted in with that.
No, that's a good one. No, we liked it.
you guys came up with some very good ones. I would say, well, the area that, you know, I've always been most interested in is neuroscience. And finally, there's some light finally beginning to dawn on how we can create brain-computer interfaces. And I was stunned when at this year's electronic show, they had the first video game video game controller that was really a helmet you wear that based its movement on EEGs. And what blew me away was this research is still going on for patients who have locked-in syndrome, getting them to be able to utilize computers so that they can communicate, and you know, in essence let out that mind that they have great difficulty communicating with. But when I saw that they had literally a game console that's strapped onto your head, that blew me away. That
wow.
Was,
yeah.
That was the moment where you go, okay, the neurotechnology, the neurosociety is coming.
Well, you know, and you get to thinking, well, how far now are we away from, you know, Steve Austin?
Jack.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about Steve Austin, the Bionic Man, you know, not Stone Cold Steve Austin, but Steve, you know, the original, the guy that had the bionic legs and the arm and the eye. You know, I mean, if you can control movements on a computer screen with your brain, you know, then why can't you control something that's where your arm used to be?
Well, DARPA has been in that research for quite some time, and you know they already have primates that have been hooked up to computer consoles where they're playing video games using brainwaves. That stuff's actually been going on for a number of years, and the goal for that is to actually have for instance, plane consoles, where fighter pilots can control everything with their mind, because there is that time delay between your brain saying, squeeze the trigger, and your body actually reacting. If you can shorten that to simply the time it takes the synapses to fire, you have that much quicker reaction time.
I don't know if I trust that. What if he had just had an argument with his wife before he gets he puts on that helmet and it's just firing off all over the place.
Some delays are good, but
maybe
you can see we're cutting the delay with also.
I'm kidding, of course. But
depends on the circumstances.
That's right.
Absolutely.
But that's remarkable that they've come so far, and it seems like it's overnight, but, you know, they've been working on this stuff for 30 years.
Oh, years yeah. and years.
How long, PJ, before we're in a completely submersive experience where it's, you know, the Matrix, right? Not even the Matrix, but just a good, like...
real VR.
Second Life with, I don't have to, like, try to figure out the keyboard commands, right? I'm just thinking it, and it's happening, right?
You know... I don't know. If I, you know, I talk to my friends who actually do this stuff, they, like you, are extremely optimistic. And a lot of them say, oh, you know, within 10 years. But I don't know if you've noticed, but it's always, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. It's
it's funny how that becomes, in some cases that becomes 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. But in other cases, it's remarkable how often now it's becoming, you know, you say 20 years and it becomes 5 years, you know.
Absolutely. And the other interesting thing that we don't realize is because we don't think about the other things that are being developed simultaneous to the developments we're specifically looking at, those things that run in parallel also are game changers to the very thing you think, well, it'll take 10 years.
Right.
And it may either lengthen that process or shorten that process. You know, computers are a perfect example. You know, we think about certain forms of medical research, and think how much longer some of this would have taken if we hadn't done all the genomic research.
That's right.
Exactly.
It's. I don't know how people honestly can prognosticate and give it a real honest to God timeline, but I certainly know personally plenty of people who are trying to create real AI-independent agents within virtual worlds, and
wow.
Good luck to them.
Well, one of the things we might truly see, I mean, that we will definitely see, is this kind of shortening of cycle times between changes, because we've already seen it. I mean, we've seen it our whole lives, but it seems to be touching on so many different areas now, and you have this convergence of so many different things being developed at the same time, which I think, PJ, is what you're talking about, and so many different people doing related things that new breakthroughs just can't help but sort of, you know, show up when we least expect them.
And it's also the chipping away aspect, which I find so fascinating. If, you know, every single day I'm reading some kind of science feeds, and when you see the number of people who are in certain areas of research working simultaneously on each tiny aspect of this research, you have to begin to wonder, okay, at what point does somebody pull it all together?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I have a question, and this might lead into a discussion that might take a little too long or whatever, but...
Before you say that, let me tell you, okay. We've got at least one vote from the chat room that we go the whole 90 minutes tonight. So.
Okay, well, good. Then I've got a topic that's going to take us another 20 minutes
to
talk about.
Yeah.
Okay, technological singularity. Okay.
Define
what that is.
Okay.
Define what the technological singularity is in the most basic terms. The arrival of people or machines that are smarter than people are today. Okay. And when does that happen? Has it happened already? That's another question I have. And Phil, go. You know, I mean, I hate to put you on the spot, but
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay.
When does it happen, or has it happened already?
Can I ask a question first?
Yes, please.
I mean, let me throw something just to confuse the issue.
Yeah.
Define, you touched on it, define smarter than we are now.
Okay, well, how about smarter than people were born, let's say, smarter than we were.
Yeah, I'm smarter than I was.
Right now, I can guarantee, are all three of us sitting in front of a computer screen?
Absolutely.
So we have access to an unbelievable amount of information. I can now, at any moment, find out the answer to most questions that have answers.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. That's so remarkable. I still.
You know, people at cocktail parties in the 1970s, if you walked up to a conversation and you didn't know what they were talking about, you'd nod politely and act like you knew what you were talking. They were talking about. And then probably you would never know.
Go on with your life, yeah.
But
you go on your life and you'd never know.
Yeah. They all went out their iPhone.
Yeah.
And they sit there and go, hey, hold on a second. I'll tell you the answer.
Excuse me, I need to go to the bathroom. And then you come back and you go.
It's almost as good as in the Matrix when he dialed in to learn how to fly a helicopter, you know. Yeah. It's not quite that good, but it's getting there. And I think that's kind of the point I was making with the side question of, has the singularity already happened? In some real ways, it may already have, because I half in jest, I told PJ a couple of shows ago that I claim Google is part of my brain now.
I do too.
And then there's a lot of people that quite seriously that are using pharmaceuticals to up their brain power, things with like Adderall and Provigil and different things like that to function at a higher level than you would normally be capable of. And whether you think that's a good thing or not, it's happening. And apparently I haven't experimented with these things. I don't know, but apparently it works well enough that people are doing it all the time. So.
Look, I've never gotten past caffeine.
Yeah,
but,
that's the old one that everybody uses.
Exactly.
Everybody uses that one.
And I can actually confirm that I write better on caffeine. But I am fascinated by the idea that we have already improved ourselves. You know, again, it's that idea that it's a continuum. But also, at what point, there has to be, as you guys call it, the game changer, there has to be that moment where either the individual or the machine is so intelligent that it's making discoveries at such a rapid rate that it's the rest of the world that isn't catching up. That's as
Does there have to be a moment, PJ? Does it have to be a moment, or does it have to be a continuum where we just sort of slide into this thing called the singularity, where it happens like, you know,
the
old thing, you put a frog in water and then you turn up the heat? It could be something like that where it happens gradually and it's on us.
And we're already in some very hot water here.
Yeah, exactly. We've already, before we realize it, the singularity happened 5 years ago and we just are realizing it.
Well, but is it a quantitative or a qualitative difference, I think, is the other thing you have to look at. And let me go back to your original question, because the terminology that my friends at the Singularity Institute use, and when I was at the Singularity Summit, they made a point of saying, is we're talking about the emergence of greater than human intelligence, right? That's the term they use, not something smarter than us than we were, because you know, it's like the next level up, right? To your point, PJ, that you can somehow draw a line and say that was human intelligence. Now
this is something else here.
Here's this other thing.
Yeah.
Because you know, the point is we can do a lot of things a lot faster. But back in the day, let's go back to your 1967 cocktail party. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Somebody brings up, you know, plastics, right? And they're talking about polymers or something, and you really don't know anything about it, but you could. You know, the next day or whenever it reopened, go to the public library and you could look up a lot of information on that. And you know what I'm saying? You could do what we're currently doing with Google and all that kind of stuff.
But did you?
Well, there's also the issue of the Flynn effect if you buy into IQ research, which, you know, I have my issues with to begin with. But the Flynn effect is that we actually had a quantitative increase of IQ across the board around the world. Measurably over the last century.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And it's probably because we're so much more engaged with information than we were. We have so many more opportunities to be, and because IQ tests are testing that ability to interact with information. Fundamentally, that's what they're testing. It's no wonder we score higher. I mean, it's no wonder as a species we're scoring higher.
It's the Red Queen thing. You have to run harder and harder to stay in the same place.
Right.
Just to compete with your peers.
But if there was going to be a qualitative change, if there was going to be a big leap, what would it be? What would it look like? Or can we just can't say because that's why.
Well, that's the definition of the singularity, isn't it?
Yeah,
we
don't
can't
know.
Say. It's the ultimate game changer.
Yeah.
We don't even know what the game looks like or might contain.
After that, yeah.
Right.
We can say we can basically say one intelligent thing about what happens after the singularity, and that those smarter beings spend some of their effort making themselves even smarter.
Right, exactly.
Mm, exactly, yeah. And we know that because we know that's something we...
That's something we want to do. Yeah.
Right.
That's something we're engaged in. And so if...
We assume, yeah, you don't get past the singularity and go, nah, I don't like
no,
it.
No, this is good enough. I'm smart enough
you
now.
You start backing out. That
yeah.
would be really disappointing if that happened, I think.
Wouldn't it be a nice idea to be able to, you know, cure cancer before breakfast?
Yeah, exactly. Or to solve that level of problem.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and then by lunchtime have done, you know, something like a personal flight or something. You know, yeah. If you're that brilliant, and then it's just no telling what a being that's that smart could come up with. So.
But I sincerely doubt it's going to be the issue of a being. I think again we have to think at the level of systems.
Yeah.
It's something that when you're dealing with the amount and complexity of information that whatever it is, be it biological or mechanical, is processing.
It's funny. It's interesting you should say it that way. I wonder, are you saying that perhaps it could be like people interacting in ways that are so close that, you know, it becomes in essence a hive mind or something like that. I mean,
well, there's that aspect. I mean, you could do, and it could be, you know, it could be an electronic hive mind. It could be an organic hive mind. But when you're looking at some of these problems that we, you know, I joke, curing cancer before breakfast, you're talking about problems that have unbelievably complex systems behind them. I mean, the very fact, again, with cancer, that it probably isn't a single disease. It's probably several diseases.
Right.
Some of them are triggered by viruses or bacteria. Others of them are triggered by DNA. I mean, who knows? So if you have something that's so unbelievably complex, can something other than a distributed system solve it? I don't know. This is not my area of expertise.
PJ, we have a caller, and I'm gonna, if it's okay, I'm gonna go ahead and bring
it.
I'm gonna bring him in. Hi, caller. You're on Fast Forward Radio.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Hi.
Could you give us your name and tell us where you're from?
Okay, we're gonna mute that caller. Okay.
You get any of these often?
That's the first time we've had a complete. Complete one that's out to lunch like that.
That was fun. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Well,
thanks for calling.
Yeah.
And,
nice thoughts.
Take those meds.
Any rate, that's hilarious. But any rate, I'm sorry, PJ, you were in the middle of saying something that was it was interesting, and I interrupted you bringing a caller. So.
No, I just, again, it's the idea that these ideas are so complex. Is it a single cognitive system that's solving these problems, or not?
Yeah, I mean, and like you say, it could be it could be a hive mind, or it could be multiple systems working together. Interesting. Okay.
Well, what you know, what is Wikipedia, if not a hive mind? You know, what are these social networking communities? They all have hive mind aspects to them. You think about the blogosphere as kind of this enormous sets of minds working on problems. Although the blogosphere doesn't solve a lot of problems, it just creates a lot of yak.
I was
right?
going to say it talks about a lot of problems. It doesn't solve
yeah, it talks
a lot of
about
problems.
A lot of problems. Kind of like these podcasts, I guess. Really.
No, it's I have a I guess a little bit of a doubt of the wisdom of crowds. It's a nice idea, but I have yet to see. I have yet to see it solve as many problems as I think it would like to believe it solves.
Yeah.
I think that's probably true. In fact, our guest last week, James Hughes, didn't he say something?
Yeah, he was a little bit down on the whole idea, even the Army of David's idea that Glenn Reynolds had brought up. He in essence said, "Yeah, we got plenty of Davids now, people that are enabled by the technology, but I don't see them getting together in armies to accomplish much yet," which is kind of a shame. It seems like that there's been some good that's come out of the blogosphere, I don't know that I agree completely with our guest there on that, but I can see that he's had some difficulty in getting together, his group to accomplish things, I think, and I think that's part of what went into that. But
to be fair, I guess you guys were talking about transhumanists. It is like herding cats.
Right. Yeah.
Got a lot of very iconoclastic, idiosyncratic people
who tend to be smart people. I'm sure.
Yes, they tend to be very smart people. Yeah. But they.
They're not used to being followers,
or
being soldiers. They're
exactly
used to being the
right.
generals in their groups, and so you get them all together, and everybody wants to be the general.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So.
Well, and there's an aspect of that, I think, too, for the when you look at the blogosphere, everybody can, be the pundit, right? Everybody can be the expert. Nobody has to be the support person who's actually going to go out and implement great ideas. Everybody can be the one, we can all set up our blogs and philosophize as to what the grand lofty vision for how to make the world work right would be. Although when the speculist does that, that's actually a very valuable thing.
Absolutely.
I'm talking about those other blogs.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Talking myself out of a job here. We should have stopped at 60 minutes.
No doubt. Well, PJ, you had said at one point that you were not a techno-utopian. I think that it's fair to say that I think that's a good way to be. And my thought on that is that, I'm optimistic about the future. I think we will have problems, a lot of problems in the future that we have to deal with. I think some of our advances are going to create new problems.
By definition, they almost have to.
Yeah. When you change things, you get new sets of things you've got to deal with.
And the sets of things we're dealing with, again, it's that issue of complex systems. These systems are getting more and more complex that we're grappling and trying to get a handle on. And as we interject ourselves technologically into these systems, we'll come up with new problems that we went, oh my God, I never thought of that. Crap. But that's, the optimistic part of me is that that's the nature of the human endeavor. It's what we do. We've always done it,
yeah.
And we'll continue to do it. And thank goodness, or if the Flynn effect is actually true, thank goodness we're actually all getting a little bit smarter because we need it.
I think that techno-utopia is in the eye of the beholder. And the interesting thing about a techno-utopia is we currently live in one.
Yeah.
But once you get to one, it's real life and it doesn't feel like utopia. There's a great example. I think I saw it on somebody's blog, The Economist, what's his name? I can't think of it. But anyway, he's talking about, in the 19th century, this guy proposed this idea for spreading happiness around the world. And his idea was the telephone had just been invented. So what you would do is you would have a symphony orchestra playing all the time. You'd bring, musicians, they'd work shifts, and they'd go graveyard. And just 24 hours a day, the symphony would be playing. And anytime anybody wanted to, they could dial a number, right, and it would connect to where this orchestra was playing, and you could actually hear music, and it would be wonderful, so that if anybody wanted to ever listen to some music, they'd be able to use this new invention, the telephone, and they'd be able to listen to the music. And you think, you take this guy and you show him the world of, the MP3 player.
Right. I mean, you forget about radio and everything else, right?
Yeah. And
right.
This is a techno-utopia. I mean, this is beyond his, literally beyond his wildest imagining of what could be possible in terms of, and for him, this was, you know, just the ultimate vision of how you could spread happiness in the world would be, to, you know, to make music available to people. And the way that that has actually happened, but all this other stuff has happened too, right? It's like, yeah, we do have this great means. For one thing, it hasn't actually brought about as much happiness as we would like.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
All those affected teenagers are a perfect example.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, there's just a lot of other problems, too.
I think our caller was a good example of that.
Well, there you go.
You know, oh, gosh.
The point is, we can look ahead to unbelievably wonderful things happening. And those unbelievably wonderful things will happen, but they'll be in a context of a very complicated world where there's still risks. And there's still bad things happening.
But I do think there is an increase, a proportional increase with risk that comes with the increase in your utopian technologies. You know, it's like anything else. Everything can be used for good or for evil,
to sound
really melodramatic. So, you know, all of these communication technologies get turned around and everyone's spying on each other. All of these cognitive technologies get turned around and people's minds can be manipulated. You know, I am the first person to say, hey, sign me up for, you know, the brain jack, you know?
Yeah.
I'm ready. But then the issue, of course, becomes, well, hold on a second. Then who am I letting into my head?
Right, yeah. What happens when somebody else decides to...
Yeah, take up residence there.
That caller, right?
Yeah, the caller, exactly.
Exactly. So I guess from my point of view, yes, there are always positive aspects, there are always negative aspects. The problems become, again, as the systems become more complex, the negative aspects become scarier. You know, I think nanotechnology is fascinating and will have extraordinary ability to change life for the better. It also has the ability to end life.
Yeah.
So, you know, I still believe, and yet I am still an optimist. I still believe, you know, we've been dancing this dance for hundreds of thousands of years, and we'll continue to dance this dance of trying to embrace the positive and mitigate the negative.
Two steps forward, one step back.
Exactly right.
Over and over. Yep.
But it's going to take that much more work as we keep on creating more and more technological systems that do these extraordinary things.
That's it. You know, good things can happen. Bad things will almost certainly happen, and we've got a lot of work to do. I guess that pretty much...
So get to work, everybody.
Yeah.
We should probably wrap it up now because we're gonna start losing our live listeners if we don't.
So. Oh, okay. Well, what do you got? Did you line up some incredibly awesome New Year's Eve music for us?
Well, you know, it's funny. We have. Can anyone put a number on the number of Christmas songs there are? I mean.
At least 20.
Yeah, I would have guessed that there's probably more than that.
Well, there's about five they play on the radio, though, because you keep hearing the same ones over and over. But, yeah, there are quite a few Christmas songs.
There's just one New Year's song, you know, as far as I'm concerned. What I've got here for you is a professor that's pretty local to me. He's just right down the road at Stephen F. Austin University, Mario Ajero. He runs a great piano blog. With great piano music on all the time, so it's just him playing "Auld Lang Syne." So let me go ahead and play that.
All right. Well, thank you.
Happy New Year to y'all.
Happy New Year,
PJ. Thanks for being on the show with us. Happy New Year, Stephen, to you and your family. And we will look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.